The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the February 14th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell. They are in a, looks like a boxing ring. Donald Trump is wearing a robe. He's got his hand raised in a sign of victory. He's got a crown on his head. He's got a black eye and a bruised cheekbone. Mitch McConnell's wearing the referee outfit, and he's got Trump's arm raised, holding it up, and he's also got a Trump 2020 button on his lapel. So the title is The Victor. Were Republicans justified in acquitting Trump? And no surprise, that is our first main story. Senate Republicans acquit Trump. What happened? The Senate brought the third impeachment trial in U.S. history to a swift conclusion this week, acquitting President Trump of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress after voting earlier to preclude witness testimony and new evidence. The dramatic votes saw all 47 Democrats vote to convict on both charges, but one Republican, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, broke ranks with his party to convict Trump on abuse of power. The president, Romney said in a speech delivered from the Senate floor, is guilty of an appalling abuse of the public trust. Romney called Trump's attempt to pressure Ukraine to investigate Democrats before the 2020 election a flagrant assault on our electoral rights, our national security interests, and our fundamental values. Trump's acquittal was all but assured by an earlier Senate vote, 51-49, to bar witnesses, with Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Romney the only Republicans to join Democrats in supporting new testimony and evidence. Several Republican senators, including Marco Rubio of Florida, Rob Portman of Ohio, and Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, conceded that Trump's actions in freezing $391 million in military aid to pressure Ukraine to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden were wrong and inappropriate, but did not warrant a prolonged and divisive trial and new testimony. "There's no need," Alexander said, "for more evidence to prove something that has already been proven." The vote to bar witnesses came as the New York Times reported that John Bolton, the president's ousted national security advisor, claims in an unpublished book that Trump ordered him to aid his Ukraine pressure campaign as far back as May, 2 months before the July 25th phone call in which Trump asked Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky to do us a favor, though. Bolton said Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, was at the meeting, along with White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney and White House Counsel Pat Cipollone, who repeatedly said during the trial that no quid pro quo existed. What the editorials said. Senate Republicans abandoned their duty to act as the ultimate guard against a dangerous president, said the New York Times. Faced with a choice of upholding their oaths to support and defend the Constitution, they instead cynically voted to forego testimony from the very people with the most direct knowledge of the actions that led to impeachment. By doing so, they tacitly pledged fealty to a would-be autocrat and the most corrupt president in modern times and emboldened him to cheat again in the 2020 election. Lamar Alexander got it right, said NationalReview.com. Yes, House managers did prove that Trump tried to get Ukraine to investigate the Bidens, But the president's actions, while improper, do not meet the high threshold for removing him from office and barring him from 2020 election ballots. It would rip the country apart, Alexander said, pouring gasoline on the fire of cultural divisions that already exist. We couldn't agree more. Let the voters decide. What the columnist said. The Republican Party's capitulation to Trump is now complete, said Peter Wanner in TheAtlantic.com. By choosing to defend him at all costs and thus avoid the risk of personal attacks and primary challenges, Republicans have become fully complicit in the corrupt enterprise that is the Trump presidency. It's sad to see once principled people choose servility to a cruel, indecent, and lawless man who's transformed the GOP's brand into angry ethnic populism. In laying the intellectual foundation for acquittal, Trump's defense lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, made a legally laughable argument, said Maya Wiley in NBCNews.com. The former Harvard professor said that so long as a president doesn't commit a crime and he believes that his own reelection is in the public interest, then any use of presidential power he takes to retain his office is not an impeachable offense. This stunning argument, which would make the Founding Fathers gasp, should terrify Americans, as it essentially turns a president into a king who can justify any act that keeps him in power. House Democrats guaranteed that Trump would be acquitted, said Matt McCoyack in the WashingtonExaminer.com. Instead of mounting a thorough and deliberate investigation of Trump's actions, they played partisan games from the very beginning, taking depositions in secret and leaking the most damaging morsels. They refused the president counsel or the ability to compel witnesses and rushed a floor vote after only 3 months, the fastest impeachment in modern history. By making the process hyperpartisan, Democrats doomed it to failure. It is now clear is that the impeachment process, as the founders envisioned it, is broken, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. They hoped that Congress would overcome partisan affiliation and oust a rogue president to protect its own power as an equal branch of government. That is, in fact, what happened in 1973 when outraged Republicans helped force Richard Nixon from the White House. But in 2020, loyalty to Trump is what defines a Republican. The Constitution has no answer for a president whose fortunes are so closely aligned with those of his congressional allies as to be inseparable. And we'll read the second main story this week. Buttigieg's big surprise amid Iowa's disaster. What happened? The race for the Democratic presidential nomination was left in turmoil this week after a vote-counting debacle in the Iowa caucuses, with Pete Buttigieg surging to an apparent victory and Senator Bernie Sanders notching a strong second-place finish. A breakdown in the reporting of results left newscasters struggling to fill airtime and candidates giving speeches without knowing how they'd fared. Results took 2 days to drip out. With 86% of the precincts in, they showed the former South Bend, Indiana mayor with 26.7% of state delegates to Sanders' 25.4%. Joe Biden trailed badly with 15.9% behind Senator Elizabeth Warren, who took 18.3%. Senator Amy Klobuchar was fifth at 12.1%. The poor start for Biden added fuel to worries about a candidate who has struggled on the stump despite strong poll numbers. But the win was a shot in the arm for Buttigieg, the first openly gay presidential contender. It's an astonishing victory, he said, for a campaign that some said should have no business even making this attempt. On caucus night, the breakdown in reporting overshadowed the vote, thanks to the failure of a hastily developed and largely untested vote reporting app. Desperate Iowa officials tried to call in the state party, waiting on hold for hours. In Des Moines, a precinct captain even tried to drive the results over to party headquarters, only to get turned away. With paper backup, Iowa officials assured voters results would be accurately counted. But the confusion opened a door for claims from Republicans that the vote must have been rigged. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "The fix is in, again." And we get to watch it play out on live TV. What the editorial said. So much for the party that promises technocratic management of American health care, energy, and finance, said the Wall Street Journal. There are real consequences to such incompetence and hypocrisy. The chief beneficiary may be Sanders, whose supporters believe party bosses robbed him of a clear-cut victory. Meanwhile, Biden's performance shows that perhaps Michael Bloomberg, who sat out Iowa and is spending big elsewhere, is the party's best bulwark against a socialist takeover. "Stick a fork in Iowa," said the New York Daily News. "We already knew letting the caucuses lead off the primary season grants outsized influence to a state that's too small, too rural, and too white. And we knew the caucusing process, whose demands rule out all but the most dedicated participants, was undemocratic. Now I add Monday's debacle wrapped inside a mockery of a sham, and this should be the end of it. Tradition is well and good, but this tradition has just killed itself." What the columnist said. The big winner was Pete Buttigieg, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, which also makes him the biggest loser. The botched vote count deprived the underdog winner of his moment and left his early victory speech sounding obnoxious. Meanwhile, the loser in the vote, Biden, became the main beneficiary of the debacle, with the caucus disaster obscuring just how much he slipped beneath his polling. "Robbed alongside Mayor Pete were America's gays and lesbians," said Tim Miller in TheBulwark.com. "This was their time, too, and they deserved a moment to revel in it." Amid the chaos, there was one clear victor, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Donald Trump. The Democratic Party kicked off the 2020 campaign with a marathon infomercial for its own administrative incompetence and internecine enmity. The fiasco made a joke of Democrats' pledge to protect democratic norms, even as it inflamed the party's most wrenching internal disputes. Republicans were ready to exploit the opening and sow doubts about the legitimacy of the vote. That's a preview of coming attractions, said Margaret Sullivan in the Washington Post. In the vacuum that followed the glitch, both aggrieved voters and Republican opportunists turned social media into a cesspool of toxic Iowa conspiracy theories. All credible reporting pointed to a technical snafu, but it didn't matter. We can expect more of this in the coming months and hope the end result isn't a national nightmare where a losing candidate supporters refuse to accept election results. In Iowa, you could see that ugly reality taking shape. Our controversy of the week is titled State of the Union. Did Trump make the case for re-election? It was the first reality show State of the Union in American history, said Ben Jacobs in NYMag.com. President Trump this week pulled out all the tricks he learned on The Apprentice to turn the usually tedious SOTU into a spectacle. Greeted by a chant of four more years from Republicans, Trump used his address, titled The Great American Comeback, to mix factually tenuous claims about his own accomplishments with partisan attacks on Democrats. For added drama, a soldier on leave from deployment in Afghanistan came down the aisle to hug his weeping wife and children. A fourth-grade girl was awarded a scholarship. And First Lady Melania Trump draped the Presidential Medal of Freedom over the neck of right-wing talk radio pioneer Rush Limbaugh, who announced earlier in the week he has cancer. On the eve of his certain acquittal by Senate, Trump never uttered the word impeachment, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. But he seemed to be in a sullen and combative mood. He ignored the offer of a handshake from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as he handed her a copy of his speech, which she ostentatiously tore up when the president finished delivering it. The speech itself was clearly designed to excite and rally his political base. The American comeback Trump was focused on was his own. Trump's angry, in-your-face delivery may have upset Democrats, said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. But this speech was a home run. Trump reminded voters that the economy is booming, unemployment is at historic lows, and that poverty is in retreat. Even voters who find Trump distasteful in personality will have to reckon with those facts in November. The Democrats, meanwhile, disgraced themselves, said Michael Goodwin in NYPost.com. They sat stone-faced through Trump's recitation of good economic news, and Pelosi, seen squirming and mumbling to herself throughout the speech, plumbed a new low for congressional decorum when she tore up Trump's speech and dropped it like a dead fish. Pelosi's gesture was a symbolic fact check, said Annie Lowry in TheAtlantic.com. Trump's boast that the economy is roaring and the best it's ever been is plainly false. Last year, it grew at a solid but modest 2.3% pace, half of what it was in the 1990s. And 2020's projected growth is only 2.1%, about the same as it has been during the decade-long expansion that began under President Obama. During the last 3 years of the Obama presidency, in fact, the economy added an average of 227,000 jobs per month, compared with the 191,000 in Trump's first 3 years. As for Trump's claim that we are restoring our nation's manufacturing might, his trade war has hit blue-collar firms hard, leading to layoffs, farm bankruptcies, and billions in bailouts. On health care, said Jim Newell in Slate.com, Trump made the truly outrageous claim that he would always protect patients with pre-existing conditions. His administration has repeatedly tried to kill the Affordable Care Act, which guarantees that very protection, and even now is backing a lawsuit that would declare the ACA unconstitutional and leave tens of millions uninsured. Trump's condo salesman braggadocio may have left coastal liberals rolling their eyes, said Rick Wilson in TheDailyBeast.com, but his flair for lowbrow political spectacle got him elected in 2016, and it may get him reelected in 2020. The fact is that Trump and the people around him are better at campaigns than Democrats are. If they want to beat him, Democrats had better up their game. It's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for skipping the small talk. After a Japanese pub introduced a robot bartender that can rapidly mix drinks and pour beers. I like it because dealing with people can be a hassle, said patron Satoshi Harada. With this, you can just come in and get drunk. It was a good week for proving the obvious. After a new study in the International Journal of Psychology found that drivers of luxury German sports cars are more likely to be self-centered men who are argumentative, stubborn, disagreeable, and unempathetic. And it was a good week for Bill and Melinda Gates, who announced they were donating $100 million to help in the detection and treatment of the Wuhan coronavirus and accelerate the development of a vaccine. But it was a bad week for cover-ups after President Trump congratulated the great state of Kansas when the Kansas City Chiefs won the Super Bowl. He quickly sent out an amended tweet hailing Missouri, home of the Chiefs. But Trump loyalists pointed out that there is a Kansas City in Kansas, which is true, though it lacks an NFL franchise. It was a bad week for recycling after officials in Baltimore County, Maryland, admitted the county hasn't actually recycled any glass in the past 7 years, despite requiring residents to place discarded bottles and jars in recycling bins the entire time. And finally, it was a bad week for Full Disclosure. With the arrest of two Florida men who were found to be transporting large quantities of illegal narcotics in a bag printed with the words, "Bag full of drugs." In a Facebook post, Florida police cautioned criminals against such labeling, since our canines can read. And a short news piece before we move on. Senate hears from IRS whistleblower. Senate investigators interviewed the IRS whistleblower who claims at least one political appointee at the Treasury Department tried to tamper with the annual audit of President Trump or Vice President Pence, the Washington Post reported last week. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, and Ranking Member Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, received a transcript of remarks from the career IRS official. The Trump administration downplayed the allegations, saying they came from secondhand information. Although the allegations remain largely undisclosed due to strict secrecy rules surrounding tax filings, the report came to light last August when Representative Richard Neal, Democrat from Massachusetts, cited it in court as part of a lawsuit to force the release of Trump's tax returns. Our briefing page article gets us a little away from all the political news. It's titled, "A Pig Problem." Dozens of states are being overrun by aggressive feral hogs who eat everything in their path. Can they be controlled? How many feral hogs are there? Their population has exploded to an estimated 6 million across 39 states, with the greatest concentration in the South, particularly Texas. Feral hogs, also known as wild boars, wild pigs, and razorbacks, are prodigious breeders, have few natural predators, and are voracious, causing $2.5 billion in damage to farms and ecosystems annually. Like all pigs, the feral variety are omnivores and will devour anything they can tear up with their long snouts and 6-inch long razor-sharp tusks, including crops, gardens, frogs, worms, eggs, and even deer and lambs. They favor plants, and 50 pig herds or sounders can empty a whole field of corn or wheat overnight. The invasive species has spread far and wide largely because it is well adapted to its environment and breeds so rapidly, with ranchers and hunters making the problem worse by trucking wild hogs into new areas so they can be shot for sport. Hunting them to control their population hasn't worked. You'd have to shoot 70% of the feral pig population every year just to keep it static. Where did the hogs come from? Their roots on this continent can be traced to Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto, who brought black Iberian pigs to America around 1540. The pigs flourished in the New World, with some escaping to create a feral population. These wild pigs would later crossbreed with Eurasian wild boar, brought into the U.S. for hunting in the 1890s and 1930s, producing what Canadian animal science professor Ryan Brook calls a super pig, weighing 200 to 500 pounds, capable of running up to 30 miles per hour, faster than sprinter Usain Bolt, and equipped with a wily intelligence that enables them to learn from their experiences. They're one of the smartest animals on the planet, says wildlife biologist Alan Leary. They're also among the most prolific. Female hogs or sows begin breeding at around 6 months old and crank out two litters of four to 12 piglets every year. The hogs live 5 to 8 years and are adapting to more northern climates, with their thick fur letting them migrate toward Canada. They've also learned to keep warm in colder states by burrowing into the snow to create pigloos. Yes, that was pigloos. Are they a threat to humans? Feral hogs are nocturnal and rarely attack people. Although the pre-dawn darkness last November, wild pigs attacked Christine Rollins, 59, in rural Texas and bit her to death. New York Mets slugger Yonis Cespedes missed all of last season after a wild boar lunged at him on his Florida ranch, causing Cespedes to step into a hole and break his ankle. Hogs are mostly feared, however, for their indiscriminate eating. Researchers have cut open a dead hog's stomach and found it bursting with baby sea turtles. One study found that mammals and birds are 26% less diverse in forests with feral pigs. With no sweat glands, hogs wallow in water to cool off, introducing pathogens to water systems. They can carry at least 32 diseases, and scientists have blamed E. coli outbreaks on feral hogs defecating in spinach and lettuce fields. Generally, an invasive species is detrimental to one crop, said Dale Nolte of the Department of Agriculture. Feral swine are destructive across the board. Can their population be controlled? All efforts to curtail the hog invasion have thus far been futile. Congress included $75 million in the 2018 Farm Bill for feral swine eradication. But actually wiping out the South's millions of pigs is widely considered impossible. In desperation, Texas, which has 2 million wild hogs, passed a law last year allowing people to shoot the marauders without a hunting license. And the state allows hog hunting year-round and without individual limits. Countless videos on YouTube show hunters on trucks or in helicopters blasting one scurrying pig after another like targets in an arcade game. Some ranchers even use bombs to blow up groups of hogs. Still, the wild hog population grows. Can they be eaten? Ranchers do trap feral pigs and sell them in Oklahoma and Florida to government slaughterhouses, which sell the pork cheaply. Many southern restaurants are trying to make use of the excess meat, especially from sows and young boars. At his restaurant outside Austin, Chef Taylor Hall only has to pay $35 per feral pig. The meat is very lean and has an intensely gamey flavor, but when mixed with fattier domestic pork to make a ragu for pasta, it can be absolutely fabulous, Hall said. Unfortunately, pork-loving Americans can't solve the country's greatest emerging wildlife challenge, said John Mayer, a government biologist in South Carolina. We are not going to barbecue our way out of this one. Moving into some of the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. Trump is no friend of Israel, or to Israel. Is President Trump really Israel's friend? Asked Jackson Deal. Trump's newly unveiled Mideast peace plan is certainly a gift to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who called Trump the greatest friend Israel has ever had in the White House. The so-called peace plan gives Netanyahu everything he wanted, including Trump's jaw-dropping blessing of Israel's desire to annex the Jordan Valley and all of the settlements it has constructed since 1967 in the West Bank. The Palestinians are left with less than 70% of the contested territory and no security control or real sovereignty over their state, which will be dotted with Israeli enclaves. The West Bank's 4.7 million Arabs will never accept Trump's terms, making the odds of a two-state solution drastically worse. That only further isolates Israel, fuels its harshest critics, and alienates even the most pro-Israel Democrats. endangering the bipartisan support Israel has long enjoyed, will not help ensure Israel's long-term survival. Trump doesn't care, since his only goal is to solidify the support of pro-Israel evangelical Christians for his re-election. Years from now, it will become clear that Trump has done more damage to Israel than any other president. How traffic is ruining people's lives. Kobe Bryant died because Los Angeles has become a traffic hellscape, said Nicole Galinas. Like everyone else in Southern California, Bryant got tired of the permanent freeway gridlock that degrades the quality of life there. But because he was rich and famous, he found a solution not available to most people. He bought a helicopter. The average Los Angeles commuter now spends 119 hours, about three full work weeks, stuck in traffic each year. And it's not just L.A. Across the country, the average commuter wastes 54 days delayed in traffic. Gridlock has come even to states like South Carolina and Florida, as booming populations clog the roads. Funding for mass transit has not kept up with population growth. As wealthy people turn to small planes and helicopters, and even the well-off masses can pay $200 for a commute by chopper, the airspace over cities is also becoming too crowded, a factor that led air traffic controllers to put Bryant's helicopter into a holding pattern just before it crashed. Last year, 236 people died in traffic crashes on Los Angeles' overcrowded roads. Both they and Bryant are victims of failing public infrastructure. This is an international column. China, is it doing enough to control the coronavirus? To stem the new coronavirus epidemic, the Chinese government has established a strong defense network against the invisible enemy, said Global Times in an editorial. The respiratory illness has killed more than 420 people in China and infected some 20,000 others so far. But thanks to the nation's extraordinary efforts, the speed of the virus spread seems to have stabilized. In the central Chinese city of Wuhan, the disease's epicenter, thousands of construction workers labored around the clock to build a 1,000-bed hospital in just 10 days. Some 1,400 military medics are now treating patients there. Wuhan and its 11 million residents have been placed under a strict quarantine, and most other cities have taken action to bar non-residents from entering. Chinese people are sensibly avoiding restaurants and other gathering places to avoid infection, and all citizens' health and travel records are being made known to their neighbors or colleagues. This disaster has demonstrated China's astonishing mobilization ability and solidarity. It has also revealed the system's weaknesses, said Andy Z in the Hong Kong-based South China Morning Post. Yes, the Communist Party can mobilize quickly and massively, but in early stages of the outbreak, its top-down hierarchical structure discouraged decisive action. If a local official in Wuhan had quickly banned crowds and quarantined anyone who'd been in contact with the infected patient, the coronavirus crisis might not have happened. But then that official would also have been condemned by superiors for disrupting the economy and spoiling the spring festival celebrations. Still, this disease is forcing China into a new openness, said Friedrich Burg in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. The first doctor to post about the new illness in December, Li Wenliang, was summoned and interrogated in the middle of the night and told to stop spreading rumors. Instead, the ophthalmologist published those threats from police, and now, as he updates the world from his hospital bed, he too contracted the virus. Li is being hailed as China's new hero. Online rumors are complicating the fight, said Alice Wu in the South China Morning Post. Panic shopping and hoarding has spread across the country as people crowd into stores to stock up on food and face masks, despite authorities' admonitions to stay home. Abroad, racism against anyone who looks Chinese is on the rise. In Sri Lanka, Singaporean tourists were banned from a popular hiking spot. In Indonesia, locals marched on a hotel and demanded that Chinese guests leave. In Canada, parents urged that schoolchildren from China be quarantined. "The fear is understandable," said Andrew Adewobowo in the Jakarta Post, "because it may be too late to stop a global pandemic." Within China, the number of infected people is still on the rise, while outside China, a new case has been confirmed almost every day in 14 countries. All we can do is bolster our own defenses against not only the coronavirus, but also other viruses that may strike in the future. Our feature article this week, The Last Word, also has a China theme to it. The title is, "Can China Save a Town in Maine?" "A dying town found one last unexpected hope," said journalist Ellen Berry in the New York Times. "A Chinese cardboard tycoon with a retinue of Buddhist monks and a feng shui consultant." Old Town, Maine. During the deepest part of last winter, a van pulled off the highway and followed the two-lane road that skims along the Penobscot River, coming to rest beside the hulk of a shuttered pulp mill. The van's door slid open and passengers climbed out. Seven Buddhist monks from China. Andrew Edwards, a mill superintendent from the nearby town of Lincoln, led them to a room where he had stockpiled the things they had requested for the ceremony. Oranges, limes, apples, and seven shovels, one for each monk. Snow lay deep on the ground, 2 feet of gritty, frozen crust, and he remembers worrying a little about the visitors. "They were in their, I don't know what they're called, their Tibetan outfit," he said, "with the sandals and whatnot." He stepped back and watched as the monks wandered from the boiler houses to the lime kiln, to the pulp mill, chanting, burning candles, and gently tapping a gong. Edward had grown up beside a now-defunct mill and seen the human chaos that resulted from failures and bankruptcies, the foreclosures, the layoffs, the departures of young families. So he had every reason to be curious about the new boss. Zhang Yin, known in China as the Queen of Trash, had built an empire, Nine Dragons Paper, by producing corrugated board out of recycling scrap. She was different from the American owners who preceded her, and not only because she could afford to spend lavishly on feng shui. The most startling thing about Zhang was her promise that Nine Dragons would operate the mill for 100 years, long enough to employ Edward's children and grandchildren. "People don't go back and redo these mills. They just don't," Edward said. "Mills get torn down or scrapped out, and here's Old Town in the middle of it, coming back to life." The year 2019 was, by any measure, a disastrous one for relations between America and China. President Donald Trump steered the United States into a trade war, bringing average tariffs on Chinese goods to 21.3%, up from 3.1% when he came into office. Americans' opinions of China turned sharply negative, sliding to the lowest point since the Pew Research Center began recording them. But a different story was unfolding in this battered New England mill town, population 7,500. The Chinese government had cut off the import of American recycling, jeopardizing the supply that fed Nine Dragons' broader business. To keep paper mills humming, Nine Dragons needed this mill, and the Old Town mill, cast aside by a parade of short-term investors, abandoned to the elements, needed a savior. No amount of trade war bluster would change either of these things. Along with gratitude came a tinge of apprehension, a sense that unpredictable change had come to the North Woods. "You want my honest opinion? This country is being recolonized by Asia, said Katie Boss, 77. She had grown up, as she put it, under the stack, the daughter and granddaughter of mill workers, and had a Mainer's suspicion of outsiders. Most people who do this do it out of greed, she said. But she had spotted the site manager for Nine Dragons lingering at the back of the crowd and wanted to catch him, because this was also true. Finally, after so many years, there was an opportunity to be grasped in Old Town. She dashed back to see if she could snag a job for her brother. David Mahan, president of Old Town City Council, was in his truck collecting empty bottles for his bottle redemption business when he heard there was a buyer. One owner after another had given up on the 130-year-old pulp mill, which had contributed about $500,000 annually to the city's tax revenue, said Bill Mayo, Old Town City Manager. It shut its doors for good in 2015. The mill sat empty for three winters, and holes opened in the roof. Animals sought shelter there. Most people in town expected it to be sold for scrap. The city's spirit flagged as the crime blotter documented drug bust and methamphetamine labs. The city council, struggling to fund services from a dwindling tax base, agreed to cut 20 municipal jobs. Mahan had even talked about phasing out trash collection, a service that cost the city around $330,000 annually. I think we hit rock bottom at a certain point. Then came a call about the mill. You need to come back right now, the liquidator told Mahan. Once he had parked and taken a seat in the conference room at the mill, he dialed into a call with someone he had never met, Brian Boland, vice president of government affairs at ND Paper, which already owned one pulp and paper mill in Rumford, 125 miles to the west. Mahan was stunned. I'm going. ND Paper. Are you kidding me? He said. Then Brian says, yes, ND Paper. We're affiliated with Nine Dragons. I went, whoa, okay. Once I heard that name, I was like, okay, we're in a very good place right now. If demand for pulp had wavered in the United States, it was building in China. Nine Dragons is Asia's largest producer of containerboard, which is used to make cardboard boxes and packing material. Its founder, Zhang, amassed her vast fortune by importing recycling scrap from the United States and then breaking it down into pulp that could be made into boxes. The business model was shaken in 2018 when the Chinese government sharply limited the import of American recycling scrap in a policy known as the National Sword. Paper manufacturers began searching for new sources of virgin pulp, and that decision had sent ripples all the way to Old Town, where Nine Dragons announced an initial investment of $45 million. Mahan watched as the mill became a hive of activity. 450 contractors began showing up daily at the mill, and a pizza shop opened on Main Street. When the company began interviewing candidates for 130 jobs, 1,200 people applied. ND Paper, the company's United States affiliate, seemed to bend over backward to win the goodwill of the community. It sponsored Little League teams, underwrote the Memorial Day and Riverfest parades, bought canoes from the town's other large employer, Old Town Canoe, to give out in raffles. We were short that money, but now this year, it's almost like being dropped from heaven, Mahan said. Anyone worried that Nine Dragons was another short-term owner found it reassuring to watch its investment in landscaping. The company had flown its feng shui consultant, known in the company as Feng Shui Eddie, to look over the mill complex. There were problems. The mill property was abutted by a cemetery, a slope covered with gravestones of 19th-century mill workers. This was inauspicious, Feng Shui Eddie advised, because it allowed restless spirits to peer into the factory grounds. He ordered a high 2,000-foot-long fence erected along the perimeter of the cemetery. Behind it, the mill staff planted a row of 230 saplings, peach trees, specially selected for their ability to withstand a Maine winter. It was like a belt and suspenders, said Craig Kirshner, the mill manager. The peach trees are another added layer to keep them over there, to keep the spirits in their own space, he added. It's all about keeping them on their side. At 2 p.m. on a sunny afternoon in August, Zhang, known reverently within the company as Chairlady, walked into the Old Town Mill for its grand opening. She was small and twinkly, wearing a knitted Chanel-style suit woven with gold thread and patent leather shoes with gold details. Inside her collar was tucked a strand of marble-sized gemstones. Inside the warehouse, the company had erected a white tent, fitted with decorative light fixtures and humming air conditioners. A row of Maine's most prominent politicians was seated on the dais beside Zhang. She got to her feet, her face barely visible above the lectern. In China, we have a common saying, separated as we are, thousands of miles apart, we come together by predestination, she said in Mandarin, as her son translated. Mayo presented five keys to the city, to Zhang and her husband, son, brother, and nephew, and the politicians stood to celebrate the mill's reopening. The paper industry in Maine is coming back, Senator Angus King announced. Why is this important to Maine? Because trees are what we've got. After that, mill workers got up one after another to pay tribute to Zhang. A mill shutdown leaves an awful hole in you that doesn't go away for quite some time, said Michelle Fisher, a logistics supervisor who had lived through six. Then she turned her face to Zhang, whom she called our chair lady. I don't think we will ever be able to say thank you enough, she said. You could almost smell the longing in the room. Please, let it work this time. Not everyone in Old Town was part of the celebration. The northern part of Maine is Trump country, rural and deeply scarred by the collapse of manufacturing. Derek King, a real estate developer, was drawn to Trump because of his tough line on China. He said he had watched joint ventures form in the region and that they were not always fair, with Chinese investors pressuring American partners to share technology. I think they're ripping us off, and I think they know it, and it bothers me, King said. It did not sit well with King, the way Old Town's leaders were handing the keys to the city to a Chinese tycoon. But King owns a residential property directly across Route 2 from the mill, and in its revival, he sees a market for new housing units. I feel a little hypocritical at times for being excited that they're here, he said. At times, I almost feel like the community, the state, is prostituting itself to get 130 good jobs in here. Kathy Cashman, now 64, started at the mill when she was 22. The mill's history was her history. She was there when a worker killed himself by jumping off the roof, and when a couple, who both worked there, married outside the converter. At one point, she gave her co-workers instructions, for some eventual day, to scatter her ashes from the roof of the recovery boiler. The new owners did not hire her back, and this made her bitter. Still, as the new year began, she fretted about the restart in a way that was almost protective. She made it a point to count the stacks, just to see where the steam was coming from, ticking them off one by one. The recovery boiler, the lime kiln, boiler number 5, boiler number 6, the digester room. A few days ago, she saw something she had not seen before. Steam coming out of the craft mill, and it gave her a gust of hope. You want it to succeed, she said. It might bring Old Town back to life. A version of this article was originally published in the New York Times. We'll read one of the obituaries this week for all you mystery fans out there. The suspense writer who pumped out bestsellers, Mary Higgins Clark, 1927 to 2020. Mary Higgins Clark understood exactly what her readers wanted and delivered it to them again and again. Most of her 50-plus thrillers followed a tested formula. A woman is thrown into a perilous situation and must find her way out through her quick wits and nerve. Higgins Clark's first thriller, 1975's Where Are the Children, centered on a mother who must prove her innocence when, not for the first time, her children disappear. In 1980's The Cradle Will Fall, a wicked obstetrician gynecologist uses deadly methods to cure infertile women. Hailed as the queen of suspense by her fans, her page-turner sold more than 100 million copies in the U.S. alone. Critics were less impressed, but Higgins Clark found a way to deal with negative reviews. She killed off their authors in her books. "You don't know it," she recalled thinking after reading one harsh review, "but you are going to end up dead on the floor." Higgins Clark was born in the Bronx, New York, to Irish immigrant parents who owned a thriving pub, said the New York Times. The Depression killed the business and, in turn, her father, who died when Mary was 11. She aspired to being a writer early, said the Times, but needed to earn money after leaving school and so worked as a secretary and then a Pam Ann stewardess. Higgins Clark never gave up on fiction, even after her husband died in 1964, leaving her a widowed mother of five. She wrote before dawn while her kids slept, then carpooled to work as a radio scriptwriter. Her first novel, a 1969 historical tale about George and Martha Washington, was a flop. So she decided her next book would be the kind she liked to read, a thriller. "Where Are the Children" was an almost instant sensation, said the Washington Post. She collected $1.5 million for her second thriller, 1977's A Stranger is Watching, and in 1988 signed a then-record $10.1 million deal with Simon & Schuster. In 2000, that was surpassed by a $64 million five-book contract. Higgins Clark kept writing at a furious pace. Her most recent novel, Kiss the Girls and Make Them Cry, came out in November. "The greatest compliment I can receive is, I read your darn book till 4 in the morning, and now I'm tired," she said in 2013. I say, "Then you got your money's worth." We'll go right on over to the Talking Points page with an article, "The National Debt, a Ticking Time Bomb? America is headed toward a crisis," said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. The Treasury Department reported last week that the federal deficit swelled to more than $1 trillion in 2019 for the first time since 2012. Even more alarming was the report from the Bipartisan Congressional Budget Office, CBO, predicting that $1 trillion deficits will continue for the next 10 years, eventually reaching $1.7 trillion in 2030. That means that the total federal debt will balloon to $31.4 trillion over the next decade, pushing the debt-to-GDP ratio to 98%, or the highest since World War II. And this wave of red ink is hitting us during boom years, when the country's deficits should be shrinking, so we can borrow and spend money to stimulate the economy during the inevitable recession to come. "There's little doubt who's to blame," said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. After campaigning on a promise to pay off the entire deficit, Trump has run up vast amounts of new debt to finance a military buildup and the $1.5 trillion tax cut in 2017. Unfortunately, this relentless fiscal stimulus has achieved little, despite the president's claim of stewarding the greatest economy in American history. Last year, GDP grew at 2.3%, nowhere near the 4% Trump promised, and the CBO now predicts a steady decline to 1.5% by 2025. Americans should be absolutely furious, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Republicans preach frugality with a Democrat in the White House, but burn money every time they're in power. Just watch. If Trump loses, Republicans will rediscover their old-time faith in fiscal prudence and start shrieking about how the U.S. is on the road to becoming Argentina or Zimbabwe. Don't blame the Trump tax cut, said Jake Novak in CNBC.com. The U.S. Treasury just booked a record quarter in tax revenue, $806.5 billion. If tax revenues are rising, then tax cuts can't possibly be the reason for rising federal debts. It's out-of-control spending that's the cause. Still, when the deficit bill comes due, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial, there's little doubt that the poor will end up paying for our profligacy, rather than cut defense or the vast tax giveaways and subsidies for the rich. Fiscal conservatives will target safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps. That would be redistributing wealth in the cruelest way possible, from the impoverished to the well-to-do. And we'll finish out the show today with two quotes. The first is from news anchor Jim Lehrer, quoted in the Washington Post, who says, "It is fairly easy to produce heat, but very tough to produce light." And maybe a Valentine's quote from Joan Crawford, quoted in Town and Country. She says, "Love is a fire, but whether it is going to warm your heart or burn down your house, you can never tell." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program was generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.